Jones versus the City of Elgin. Mr. Harrison.
Good morning, Judge. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court.
Counsel.
My name is Jim Harrison, and I represent the plaintiffs in this action, Natasha and Katya Dunn. This case started out on the right track and got off from the district court, interpreted valid to mean genuine. The district court held that the court's order was not facially invalid, but in fact it was. The court, and it's obvious from a reading of the district court opinion, that it used the term invalid to mean genuine, and genuine cannot be the test for the validity of a court order without having absurd results. The way that the sister states are afforded the opportunity to have their judgments enforced is through procedural due process mechanisms that are set up. And in Illinois, there are two such, with the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act and the Illinois Dissolution of Marriage Act, both of which require the filing of an out-of-state order with the Illinois court system and the issuance of summons to give the opportunity, notice and opportunity, to be heard to the individuals who are affected by that order, and particularly a minor child whose custody is at issue. The better definition for valid is enforceable, because that doesn't lead to absurd results. It is entirely an unenforceable order that was presented in the case at bar. The North Carolina order may have been genuine, but it was not enforceable in the state of Illinois. It was not a valid court order in the state of Illinois. In the Morrell case, Seventh Circuit's ruling in Morrell, the Morrell court addressed the term validate. In fact, it used the term twice in its opinion, indicating that the order had to be validated by an Illinois judge. Well, that would suggest that the order wasn't valid until an Illinois judge did, in fact, take the steps to enforce that order through the processes that are set forth. Here, what's most interesting is that the invalidity of the order was apparent on the face. The order said North Carolina. There was no Illinois stamp. There was no indication of Illinois. And all of the mitigating circumstances that were present in Morrell aren't here now. In Morrell's case, the order had been filed in Illinois. That wasn't the case here. In Morrell, the officers responded to a directive by a state's attorney who told them to do what they did. And they did what they were told to do by a state's attorney. That's not at all what happened here. The officers here didn't even know anything about the order. They were already in the act of enforcing it when Natasha Dunn asked to see it. The officer had to go outside, and he testified that was the first time that he realized it was a North Carolina order. It was when he took the order from the father outside, carried it back in, and presented it to Ms. Dunn to read. And that was the first time that she had seen it. There was no due process for Ms. Dunn.
Are you saying that just because this order is unenforceable or invalid on its face, that there's nothing they could have done to get under the umbrella of qualified immunity?
I think that an officer doesn't need to be a court of law to make determinations of validity, but a police officer certainly can take the step to look and see whether or not it's an Illinois court order, because they're not empowered to enforce other orders. They're only empowered to enforce Illinois orders. If an Illinois order tells them to enforce another court order, then that's what they're going to do. But in the absence of that, they have absolutely no authority whatsoever to serve that order. And different than the Morrell case, in our case, we do have a Fourth Amendment issue. And the Fourth Amendment's pretty clear on what's required before you can seize an individual. And frankly, those prerequisites just weren't present here. This was a child who was seized from her home by the police. And I'll give you an example of a very similar case. Daniel Gassaway, the Gassaway case. He went and took his daughter out of school. He had an order that was valid in Indiana. But it wasn't valid in Illinois, and he didn't register in Illinois. And he came into Illinois, and under that order, he took his child. Well, Mr. Gassaway had a bad result. He ended up arrested for child abduction and convicted for child abduction. And the stressing point on that was that the abduction of the child occurred as a result of an invalid order. And the court focused on that. It was a crime in that case, what happened. And went to the appellate court, and it survived as a crime. The same thing happened here, except Elgin police officers, in this instance, helped Christian Dunn, who had completely bypassed the procedural due process, to take his child and abduct the child from the state of Illinois. And the Elgin police helped. It was a crime in Gassaway, and here it's being addressed as though they had done nothing wrong. And I will note also that Gassaway predates the events in this circumstances by a number of years, 7 years or so. It was out there. Gassaway told them, you must file a court, your order with the court in Illinois and have notice and opportunity to be heard before it's enforceable or valid in the state of Illinois. And that's what happened here, is they bypassed the due process requirements and resulted in a constitutional tort. Why did all this happen? Because the city failed to train its officers. That's why it happened. And it's very simple. You're talking about a case where officers were ordered, at best, to stand by. Unfortunately, officers weren't told what that means. They weren't instructed on standby service. Yet the district court found, as well as all of the defendants admitted, that this is a routine duty of police officers. They stand by on every shift. That not only do they do it for bank runs and other instances, they do it for exchanges of property, and they do it for exchanges of child custody. And I put it to you that when you're exchanging child custody, constitutional issues should come within the minds of the municipal policymakers. And here, it just didn't happen. They had a policy under standby service when officers were told to go outside or were told to stand by while Mr. Dunn collected his child. They didn't do that. The person who stood by was Mr. Dunn. He stood outside. These officers took and went inside and enforced an order. They didn't stand by. They enforced an order. And it's important that the district court granted the fact that they enforced the order, but it's important to know that they enforced the order when they were told to stand by. That's significant. It's not just like they enforced an order. They were told to stand by. But they didn't know what that meant, or they had a different opinion of what that meant.
I thought you just learned they do that all the time.
They do standby service. They do.
They do know what it is.
Well, you would think so, but if standby
service... Well, the fact that they violated the rule makes Elgin the one to tell them...
They didn't violate the rule. Elgin found that their conduct was consistent with their standby service. No violation.
Well, I thought you said the standby just required their standing by, not doing anything.
Well, that's what one would suggest from the term standby in common, ordinary use of it. But if the city of Elgin, it means far more.
You mean you have to put a negative in that you stand by and don't do anything, add to it, or?
No, in fact, the testimony was it was a peacekeeping role.
Right.
Standby for peace.
Stand by and make sure nobody gets in a pitch battle over the whole program.
But that's not what happened.
I know that's not what happened. We're talking here about what Elgin's training is.
Elgin has no training. They say
stand by.
There is a term called standby that are used to dispatch officers to a scene, and those officers, some of them, are told during some point in their training that standby equals peacekeeping.
What would you think if you went to some place and they told you, your job is to stand by?
Well, I was a sheriff's deputy for many years before I was a lawyer, and standby meant we stood by and we made sure that problems didn't
happen.
We didn't enforce orders, but we stood by. Yes, Judge.
They just said you spoiled them all out, or you found out by yourself.
No, in fact, we were told during our field training what we did when child custody exchanges were to occur. And we were sheriff's deputies at the time who were lawfully able to enforce civil process, not city police officers who have no statutory rights to do that or statutory authority.
It's one of the reasons they say they didn't know that's not their normal duty. They say normally the sheriff's department does that.
Yes, and for good reason. That's what the statute says. The sheriff's department will serve civil process, not municipal police officers. But they didn't serve the process. They enforced the out-of-state order.
Mm.
And they did it under...
I'm more concerned with whether or not the Sicilian Union has anything to do with the fact that they didn't stand by. They did more than stand by.
The city of Elgin knew for a fact that its officers were called upon to do this duty...
To stand by.
Whatever that term meant, yeah.
Well, you just don't know what it meant.
Well, I told you what my opinion is, but if you look at Officer Lentz or Officer Kraska or Sergeant Mona McKinley, they all have a different opinion of what it means. Mm-hmm. And therein lies the difficulty. It looks like I'm into my rebuttal time. If
all right.
Thank
you, Mr. Harrison.
Thank you.
Mr. Deano?
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. I represent the City of Elgin and Sergeant McKinley, so I'll be addressing the issues relevant to those two parties. The City of Elgin was not deliberately indifferent in the training or supervision of its police officers.
What did they tell the police officers to do? What did they tell standby men?
In field training, they were instructed that standby meant you're simply there to keep the peace. You're not there to enforce any order, and all of these officers testified that they knew standby meant you don't enforce an order. You make sure that nobody gets violent and the laws aren't broken, but they're not to take any affirmative action. Sergeant McKinley testified that she knew standby meant that if somebody refused during a custody exchange to turn over the child, that the instruction was to be given to that party that they should talk to their attorney, and that they're not to take any action to enforce the order. This policy in this case, 74.2, also addressed civil process, and it said that police officers in the City of Elgin would not generally serve or enforce civil process. So if you take the two together, that in field training they're instructed that you stand by, and I think the definition of that is self-evident.
So the police officer violated the rule that Elgin had told them?
Well, I think that would be... The assumption that the district court made in this case was that the police officers did seize the child.
Well, but is that a contested issue?
Well, I think it doesn't matter for purposes of this appeal because the court applied then qualified immunity, saying that if the officers did enforce the order, then under the Morrell case, they have qualified immunity because the law wasn't clear in 2000 when they allegedly enforced the order, that they could not enforce it without first filing it in the state of Illinois.
From our point of view, we have to take the position that the child was seized.
I think that's what the district court did, and I think that's
what we do.
Right. And that's the set of facts upon
which... Well, if that is true, then it did happen. It violated the rules that the City of Elgin had laid out for the police officers.
Then it did, but it wouldn't be a constitutional violation. It would be a violation of an internal order.
Let me put that one out by myself. All I want to know is, in your opinion, then, taking that what they say is true, the officer violated the Elgin rules.
If there was a seizure, yes.
It would only show a seizure.
Okay.
Okay,
then you're right. I agree. But I think the adequacy of policy 74.2, as well as the training on 74.2 and the training in with respect to how to conduct standby service, was all adequate because of the fact that in this case we found no prior similar violations of the constitutional rights for seizure during child custody transfers or standby service. And in the absence of any pattern of misconduct that was similar to this, there would be no notice to the municipality that either the policy was deficient or the training on the policy was deficient. Because deliberate indifference would require some knowledge or notice that what they're doing is being, or at least with the policies they've had in place and the training they've given, are resulting in these constitutional violations. The Hirsch case and the Palmquist case that we've cited both speak to this issue, that without a pattern or history of prior misconduct, there would be no notice to the municipality and therefore no deliberate indifference. I think the case is very similar to the Robles versus Fort Wayne, which we've cited. There, it was a police officer who was performing in an off-duty capacity security, his secondary employment. And the allegation against the city for failure to train was that there had been no training of these police officers that told them that while you're serving in an off-duty capacity as a security officer, you're subject to the same constitutional standards that you would be when you're on routine patrol. And this court said that the fact that the same constitutional standards would apply whether you're on duty or acting off duty in a security capacity would be self-evident to the officer, and therefore there would be no reason to give any training or instruction to the officer that he's subject to the same constitutional standards when off duty. And that would apply in this case. There'd be no need to train an officer that where you're in a peacekeeping or standby service role, you're subject to the same constitutional standards that you would be if you were on routine patrol. The final basis that I would suggest that this, the summary judgment in favor of the city be affirmed is that there was no clear constitutional duty with respect to the whether out-of-state court orders can be enforced in the state of Illinois without first being filed in an Illinois court. In 2001, in the Morrell case, this court recognized that there were no authoritative cases holding that pre-deprivation notice and an opportunity to be heard were required as a matter of constitutional due process before a state could enforce another state's court order. So if there was no clear constitutional duty, the city of Elgin cannot be deliberately indifferent in failing to instruct or train its officers on what the constitutional duty might have been. Finally, with respect to Sergeant McKinley, what she did in this case was contact the officers through a dispatcher when Christian Dunn, the father of the child, came in to the Elgin Police Department with the Elgin or with the North Carolina court order. And she contacted the two officers who were on duty through the dispatcher, and the officers were directed to perform standby service. I think the dispatch tape shows that they were told, we need standby for a child custody transfer. She did not direct them to serve or enforce this order. She had no knowledge that there was going to be any enforcement of the order. And I think under Section 1983, the only way that she could be responsible for the alleged constitutional violations in this case would be if the seizure occurred at her direction and with her knowledge and consent. And the only thing she knew was going to happen would be that there would be two officers standing by while Mr. Dunn picked up his child. And the final thing I would suggest for Sergeant McKinley is that she's also entitled to the qualified immunity because of the lack of certainty in the law at the time as to whether a North Carolina order granting custody could be enforced in Illinois without first having it filed. And I would adopt the arguments made by Mr. Condon with respect to qualified immunity.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Deanna.
Thank you.
Mr. Condon.
May it please the court, I represent officers Keith Kratzka and Jason Luntz in this case. Initially, I would briefly like to address the court on the issue of absolute immunity. Judge Zagel, in his opinion, found that the officers were in fact entitled to absolute immunity for enforcing a facially valid court order. And in that decision, Judge Zagel discussed this court's rulings in the Wolin case and in Morrell and held that unless the officers who were at the scene knew that this order had been rendered by an incompetent judge in North Carolina or under circumstances that rendered the order invalid, that they were entitled to absolute immunity for enforcing this facially valid court order. Next, I want to go to the issue of qualified immunity. In the Morrell case, this honorable court found that the officers were entitled to qualified immunity in that case because it was not clearly established at the time the officers acted that that Ms. Morrell in that case was entitled to notice and an opportunity to be heard before the order could be enforced. Similarly here, the order that we're talking about was entered on February 4th of 2000, which was prior to this court's decision in Morrell, which was in November of 2001. Similarly, the officers in our case cannot be found to have violated any clearly established constitutional law that would have let them know that it was unconstitutional for them to enforce this North Carolina order. I would note to the court that an important factor in Morrell and this court's discussion was the fact that Ms. Morrell had never submitted herself to the jurisdiction of the New Mexico court. She had never appeared there in New Mexico at any hearing there. That's not the circumstances here. In fact, Ms. Dunn, in our case, in January of 1999, went and appeared before the North Carolina court, and the judge there entered a comprehensive custody order outlining the rights of the parties. Natasha Dunn knew that that order allowed Christian Dunn to obtain visitation. She willfully denied him visitation in December of 1999.
That's not an issue here, is it?
It's not an issue here.
So why are we talking about it?
Well, we're talking about it because I believe that the court in Morrell, in its discussion, was worried about the fact that jurisdiction had never been submitted to by Ms. Morrell. And we don't have that fact in our case. Ms. Dunn had submitted herself to jurisdiction and got notice of that February 2nd hearing where Christian went in.
And Christian didn't submit himself to the jurisdiction of this state.
Well, in December of 1999, Ms. Dunn filed a divorce petition. I don't know that there was ever a hearing on that divorce petition. I don't believe the record shows that.
Well, he had not submitted himself in the issue when we're involved in this jurisdiction.
Well, he submitted himself because he was trying to attempt to obtain compliance with North Carolina, and that is the court that had jurisdiction over this custody issue.
Which court?
The North Carolina court.
Had jurisdiction over custody issue in the state of Illinois?
Well, no, it was the only court that had rendered any jurisdiction over.
But in order to effectuate that order, it is necessary that he appear before a judge in this state.
It was necessary for him to file that order with the clerk's office.
Right.
And in fact, he did not do that. Hmm. But that does not mean that the officer should have known that it was constitutionally required.
What would the clerk do with the order if he filed it?
I believe that the clerk, if filed it, would put it in the file, and at the very most, it would be incumbent upon Mr. Dunn to then serve notice, which in the Morrell case, it all happened the same day. So
I understand.
So in this instance, Mr. Dunn, in fact, got the order, and he didn't file it here, but he went...
Except for notifying the city police, he didn't know anything. Took the order from North Carolina, showed it to the city police, went, and got the child.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. So in conclusion, I believe that because the Morrell decision was decided by this court in 2001, and the officers in this case... seized the child in 2000, that they are in fact entitled to qualified immunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Conner. Mr. Harrison?
Thank you, Your Honors. With regard to the test set forth in Roble, it is not a two-part test, but a two alternative test. Either by actual notice of prior violations, if the city is put on notice, or by constructive notice, where there are obvious duties and a constitutional right is clearly impacted. We're the second Roble situation. We're not the first. And to evaluate it based upon whether there was a prior violation is not appropriate. Here, we're dealing with constructive notice, and there was a comment that there was no notice in this instance. The city was on constructive notice. The city was totally on constructive notice by the nature of these officers' duties to establish a policy that was with comported with constitutionality.
When do you think that should have come into play, and from a date standpoint?
I don't believe I understand your question.
Well, obviously you feel that Morrell does not preclude your in your case.
No, it's very different.
Right, and I understand you to say it doesn't because you just gave us the...
Because in the Morrell case, well, Morrell has similarities to our case,
yeah.
But there's many, many differences as well. In Morrell, like I said, it had been filed with the court. And the protocol, by the way, is once it's filed with the court, they also have to confirm with the jurisdiction that issued the order to ensure that it is, in fact, valid, which is, in fact, one of the definitions of the term validate. And then summons is issued in an Illinois court. And if you want to go back, you can go back to Ellis versus Hamilton in 1982, where the Seventh Circuit recognized that due process requires a hearing before a minor child is removed. That's 1982. This happened in the year 2000. Look at Gassaway, which is very clearly on point, Illinois case, very clearly on point for putting them on notice as to what their obligations were. And you're not talking about an officer having to second-guess the content of an order. He has to look for the word Illinois on the order in a file stamp. And that's not setting the bar too high when these officers are supposed to be protecting people. Now, let me tell you, this could have gone much worse. This is a child who may not have ever appeared again. Every day we look at milk cartons and things in our mailbox, have you seen me? And parents and children who are abducting their children and are gone. And this is a serious circumstance.
From some strange point of view, it might also be true that your client abducted the child from North Carolina.
Why would that be, Judge?
Well, did she have custody of the child or right to cross and take the child to Illinois?
Yes, Judge, she did.
But she did not have the right to keep Christian from seeing the child.
There was an issue as to Christmas visitation with the child. Yes, Judge, there was.
So there you go.
Well, certainly, but I don't think that allows the Elgin police officer to...
Well, I don't think it does either, but...
Well, I mean, it certainly may...
Well, I mean, milk carton works both ways. I mean,
it certainly does. Yeah. But Christian Dunn had no problem finding Natasha Dunn and taking his child.
That's
another
true.
It goes the other way around. In closing, Underwriters, which goes back many years before... the case at bar, jurisdictional challenges to out-of-state court orders were recognized back then, and the right for the home state of the child to challenge jurisdiction, and in many cases, even in the statute itself, it says that they need to determine who's the better state, what's in the best interest for the child for asserting jurisdiction. All of that was bypassed. You had two officers at 5 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning with no help available, no one to consult available. Oh, and one other point. Mona McKinley, under their policy on civil process, which this wasn't, but they testified. Mona was competent in authority to order those officers to enforce civil process. That testimony is in the record. And Mona testified, an order is an order, and we're there to enforce it. That's what she told the officer who came in and said, gee, that North Carolina order, what do you think about that? She said, an order is an order, and we're there to enforce it. And the city of Elgin said that what Mona did and what these two officers did was okay. And I think that the Constitution and the line of cases that predate this by a long time say that it's not. And this woman is lucky she got her child back. And it didn't have to turn out that way. And I thank you, Judge.
All right, thank you, Mr. Harrison. Thank you, all counsel. The case taken under advisement.